Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Catholic and Orthodox experts meet to discuss questions of authority and the primacy of the Bishop of Rome. The story of an East Timorese sister hailed as an angel of mercy for her courage and undaunted commitment to reconciliation and peace. But first, Pope Benedict continues his teaching on the early leaders of the Church. Benedict on Wednesday greeted thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered under grey skies in St. Peter's Square for his weekly general audience. This week, the Pope offered prayers for an important ecumenical meeting taking place between Catholic and Orthodox leaders, and he continued his reflections on some of the early leaders of the Church, as my colleague Emma McCarthy reports.
Autumn arrived in St. Peter's Square this Wednesday as over 20,000 pilgrims and visitors huddled under umbrellas to hear Pope Benedict XVI's latest installment in his series on the Fathers of the Early Church. Among those gathered, a group of Buddhist monks from Sri Lanka, resplendent in their bright orange robes, as well as the black and white of hundreds of Dominican religious here in Rome to mark the anniversary of the founding of their first monastery by St. Dominic, over 800 years ago. But Pope Benedict XVI's reflections were dedicated to the life and writings of another defender of the faith, who, like Dominic, dedicated his life to countering the heresies of his time, the 4th century French saint Hilary of Poitiers.
In opposition to the Arians, who believed Jesus was a created being, Hilary dedicated his life to defending our faith in the divinity of Christ. While exiled to Phrygia because of the stance he took against the Arians at the Synod of Bysias, he began his most important work, De Trinitate. In this text, he demonstrates how both the Old and New Testaments clearly attest the divinity of the Son and his equality with the Father, with whom he shares one nature. In his De Synodis, Hilary maintained a conciliatory spirit with those who use deficient theological formulations while leading them to accept fully the Nicene Creed.
St. Hilary returned home in 360 and took up his pastoral duties while continuing to write. Pope Benedict said that the influence of his teachings soon spread.
Many were strengthened in their resistance to Arian thought, realizing that Christ is our Savior precisely because he is true God and true man. Fundamental to Hilary's insight was the importance of our Trinitarian baptismal faith. Upon all of you, I invoke God's abundant blessings of joy and peace. Pater
Noster. Following the Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict's thoughts turned to the ancient Italian city of Ravenna, where all of this week leading Catholic and Orthodox theologians are meeting in the 10th plenary session of the International Mixed Commission. The Pope said the theological theme of this session is of particular ecumenical importance, as it investigates the ecclesiological and canonical consequences of the sacramental nature of the Church, ecclesial communion, and its authority. The Holy Father urged all of those present to join him in prayer for this important encounter, so that it may help the journey towards full communion between Catholics and Orthodox, and that they may soon share the same chalice of our Lord.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy reporting there on Pope Benedict's weekly general audience. As you heard there, the northern town of Ravenna, once the seat of the Byzantine Empire in Italy, is the setting this week for a meeting of the Joint International Commission for Theological Dialogue between the Catholic and Orthodox Churches. The commission is made up of 30 Catholics and 30 Orthodox experts in ecumenism, who are meeting together for the commission's 10th plenary assembly, led by Cardinal Walter Casper, head of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, and by the Orthodox Metropolitan John Zizoulas, representing the Ecumenical Patriarchate in Istanbul. The official title of the document they're discussing is The Ecclesiological and Canonical Consequences of the Sacramental Nature of the Church. That means they're examining the role of bishops, and in particular the question of the primacy of the Bishop of Rome. One of the principal causes of the schism between the West and Eastern churches nearly 1,000 years ago in 1054 was a dispute over papal authority.
This is really approaching some of the key issues that have divided Orthodox and Catholics for many centuries.
Father Ron Robison is a former member of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. He now serves as an associate director of the U.S. Bishop's Secretariat for Ecumenical and Interreligious Affairs, and he's following closely this meeting in Ravenna.
You know, within the Orthodox Church, you really have a communion of 14 or 15 independent churches known as autocephalous churches. They basically run their own affairs, and they have only a very limited understanding or experience of a center of the church that has a kind of authority to bring unity to the communion. There is the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, which is certainly a symbolic center of the Orthodox communion, but its authority is very limited and, in fact, disputed by different Orthodox churches.
So this is likely to continue to be quite a difficult issue. What are your hopes, your expectations of the meeting in Ravenna this week?
Well, I'm hoping they'll be able to come to some sort of consensus that will at least allow... The methodology of the dialogue from the beginning has been to begin with what we have in common and build a foundation upon which more difficult issues could be dealt with a bit later. And so certainly on this issue, they're trying to look at those kind of underlying ecclesiological foundations. It's a problem not only of working that out between Catholics and Orthodox, but also among the Orthodox themselves. Some of the Orthodox members, in speaking to the press after the last meeting in Belgrade last year, were talking about some of the difficulties that they had in terms of describing the Orthodox communion and the role of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. So that's something that they're going to have to work out among themselves to come to some sort of a consensus.
You mentioned there that Belgrade meeting, which was, of course, the first encounter after a six-year break due to a series of difficulties between the two sides. On a more general level, how would you characterize relations between the Orthodox and the Catholic churches at the moment?
Well, I think they are improving significantly. We went through a very difficult period after the end of communism in Eastern Europe because you had these clashes between Orthodox and Eastern Catholics, especially in Ukraine, but also in Romania and other places. But that seems to have settled down. There is kind of a modus vivendi. Things are getting better there. And I think for the first time, really Belgrade was a turning point because for the first time they're able to return to the theological agenda that had been set aside back in 1989 when the commission met in Freising. So I think it's a very significant step. You also see in different ways the common declarations that have been signed recently with heads of Orthodox churches that have come to Rome about cooperation, especially on social issues, social justice, those kinds of things. So I think you're really beginning to see an effort to work more closely together to address the issues of the current day.
As you say, we've seen some fairly encouraging signs, some very positive meetings. Just recently, Patriarch Alexei also traveling to Paris, meeting with Catholic leaders there. How much do you think this is really paving the way for a possible meeting between Pope Benedict and the Russian Orthodox Patriarch, Patriarch Alexei, in the near future?
Well, I think things are moving in that direction. I think it's going to be a while before this actually happens. But as I read in the press reports, at least, the Patriarch did make reference to the possibility of such a meeting within the next couple of years. And as far as I know, that's the first time the Russians have mentioned anything like a time frame. They've always said we've got some significant difficulties we have to address first. Such a meeting should not simply be for the cameras, but really has to be substantive and real agreements about the issues that separate us. So I think we're inching in that direction. I wouldn't hold my breath, but I think it will be happening within the next couple of years.
Going back to the talks there in Ravenna, can you give us an idea of the way in which this commission works, a little bit of the background, and who is actually taking part in these talks?
Well, the commission was established back in 1979 when Pope John Paul II went to Istanbul to meet with the Ecumenical Patriarch, Demetrius, at that time. They established the commission, and it was to involve the entire Orthodox communion as well as the Catholic Church. So on the Orthodox side, each of the churches, and again, there's 14 autocephalous churches involved and also a couple of autonomous churches, each of them appoints two members of the dialogue to represent their churches, and then the Catholic side appoints a parallel number from its side. So it's very significant because it involves all of the different Orthodox churches together. They met every 2 years for the first 10 years, dealing with different theological topics. And so it's only after the beginning of the problems in Eastern Europe that they departed from that cycle. But it looks like they're now being able to return to the agenda they set up many years ago.
The other problem that emerged, of course, with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the opening up of Eastern Europe was this question of the so-called uniates, the Greek Catholic churches, particularly in the Ukraine. How much has this problem been overcome, and how much is it still really a major obstacle to the dialogue?
Well, I think what's happened there is that, for quite some time after the end of communism, the Orthodox side was insisting that we address exclusively this question about the status and the ecclesiological meaning of the existence of these Eastern Catholic churches. And I think that they realized in Emmitsburg and Baltimore back in 2000 that there was simply, they didn't have the theological tools with which to address this question. Certainly the Catholics were insisting the Eastern Catholics are legitimate churches in full communion with us, and we defend that. And the Orthodox had some very serious questions about their right even to exist. But I think there's been a consensus reached that really the issues are more fundamental. The real issue is primacy and authority in the church. And only by addressing those questions can you fruitfully address the question of the Eastern Catholic churches. So the Orthodox have agreed to set aside the question of Eastern Catholics for a time in order to address the more fundamental questions, and only then, after there's an agreement on those things, to return to the issue of Eastern Catholics.
Do you think this meeting in Ravenna is likely to be a kind of landmark on this road then towards a fuller agreement between the churches?
Certainly there is that potential. If they can come up with an agreed statement, a theological statement about conciliarity and authority in the church, that'll be a major step forward because they're beginning to address those really key issues that have divided us for so long. So I think there's reason to be cautiously optimistic about something really significant happening this week.
My thanks there to Father Ron Robison, Associate Director of the U.S. Bishop's Secretariat for Ecumenical and Interreligious Affairs. The growing gap between rich and poor and the emergence of new forms of poverty were at the heart of an address in New York on Tuesday by Archbishop Celestino Migliore, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations there. Archbishop Migliore was speaking to a meeting of the UN's General Assembly, during which he praised efforts to implement the Millennium Development Goals and promote fairer financial and trade relationships. Here's Emma McCarthy again.
Yesterday in New York, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations, Archbishop Celestino Migliore, addressed the 62nd General Assembly, offering an assessment of the international community's successes and failures in reaching the Millennium Development Goals. Archbishop Migliore said that still today, almost 10 million children below 5 years old die each year, mostly from preventable causes, and that too many mothers die in childbirth from preventable and treatable complications. The Archbishop said last year nearly 3 million people died of HIV/AIDS-related causes, and half of the developing world lacks even basic sanitation. Archbishop Migliore said to prevent this situation from worsening, the United Nations, with the cooperation of all member states, must renew its commitment to the preservation of life at every level and in every corner of the world.
Those Millennium Development Goals, drawn up in the year 2000 by world leaders meeting at the UN, contained important commitments to overcome poverty, eliminate diseases, and promote education, especially for girls, in the poorest countries of the world. Yet almost halfway through the 15 years set as the time frame for achieving those targets, many are now questioning whether it's possible to achieve such an ambitious set of goals.
I am hopeful that some of the goals can be achieved. I mean, they were a very ambitious target, but, you know, ambition is no bad thing. I think the major threat to our world is mediocrity and apathy, not ambition. And in terms of tackling poverty and injustice, we should always strive to be ambitious.
Christine Allen is director of the London-based international development charity Progressio. The organisation draws its inspiration from Pope Paul VI's visionary social encyclical Populorum Progressio, or On the Development of Peoples, published 40 years ago at Easter in 1967. The document was partly the result of the Pope's own travels to Latin America, Africa, India and the Holy Land, where he saw with his own eyes the grinding poverty, sickness and desperation that contrasted so sharply with the economic progress and fast-growing consumer culture of Western countries. Pope Paul, like today's church leaders, saw the urgent need for the Christian message of love, compassion, justice and equality, to act as a social conscience and to speak out against the growing gap between rich and poor.
And I think there's a lot that churches and faith groups and faith leaders can contribute to that process too. There's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot that is being done. A lot of provision of services is very positive, is very good. Issues around the way perhaps women and girls get treated, perhaps churches could do more to encourage and support that. But I think in practice, there's a lot of really good work that's going on, particularly to address the needs of those that are poorest and more marginalised. In some respects, perhaps I don't think we'll meet them all, but I don't think that should be a reason why we should stop trying. And there are very clear indications that progress is being made. Perhaps it's not as fast as we'd hope it to have been, but nonetheless, progress is there. And in the same way that Paul VI talked about our recognition of the new social conscience for all, I think the Millennium Development Goals in some respects help to provide something like that new social conscience, both from the Millennium but also from the global call to end poverty. In the UK it was called Make Poverty History. Those sorts of campaigns that are really focused around holding governments to account to make sure that they meet their Millennium Development Goals targets are, I think, in many respects new social consciences and should be supported by everybody.
Christine Allen, director of the London-based international development charity Progressio. East Timor is the world's newest nation, but its road to independence in 2002 was long and bloody. After a referendum in 1999 showed overwhelming support for independence from Indonesia, loyalists went on the rampage, killing hundreds of people and destroying much of the territory's infrastructure. An international peacekeeping force halted the mayhem and paved the way for a UN mission which has helped East Timor back on its feet again. But even with this outside help, the country's first few years as an independent nation have been far from easy. Poverty and unemployment remain widespread, and in 2006, a serious outbreak of factional violence between rival gangs caused tens of thousands of people to flee their homes. Many of those displaced people fled to Catholic convents or other church organisations. Today, we shine the spotlight on an East Timorese religious sister who has become a local hero for rescuing people caught up in the gang fighting and for her courageous attempts to reconcile these warring groups. My colleague Susie Hodges picks up the story.
Known as the Angel of Mercy, Sister Germino Masao is a religious sister who ventures where other angels fear to tread. A university teacher by profession, she spends much of her time caring for thousands of people who fled their homes following the gang violence that broke out across East Timor in 2006. Sister Germino says this faction of violence is still continuing at a lower level in several areas of East Timor, and the local population remains traumatized.
We still have some kinds of violence, we still have ethnical issues, political issues, so that sometimes make people still worried to go back home, even though now we have a new government. But currently, people still have trauma in their own life. They are not sure of security issues. And also, some violence not only happen in Delhi, but around different suburbs of Delhi and other districts now happen there. Killing, destroying houses continuously in the east of East Timor. And also some part of Western Timor, though, still has violence, gun fighting among civilians. They use the guns to threaten other people, especially civilians and refugees. They cannot move around because the situation doesn't permit people to move around.
Tens of thousands of those displaced by the gang violence sought refuge in Catholic convents and other church organisations. Sister Guillermino's convent, run by the Canossian Sisters of Charity, is currently sheltering more than 6,000 of these displaced people. As a result, the convent, located in the capital Dili, is packed to the brim with the people sleeping on virtually every available space in the building and grounds, including the kitchen and library. Sister Guillermino says it's a real financial struggle trying to provide for so many people, and told us how the camp received little outside support during the height of the violence in 2006, and as a result, 5 children died of malnutrition.
Since last year, we hosted 23,000 people. They came from different parts of Delhi, different parts of the suburb of Delhi. They were looking for the safe place. Now we still have 6,558 people with us.
And is it a struggle to provide food and shelter for so many?
That's a really great problem for us to host a lot of people, facing people for problems of sanitation, problems of shelter, problems of health, problems of food, because the government working together with World Food Program provided food for these displaced people, internally displaced people, once a month. But sometimes that food isn't enough for the month. So we have to look for food from somewhere else to survive the life of these people. And also inside the camps, problems in malaria, dengue, fever, some kinds of other illness. That 5 babies passed away because of malnutrition and malaria and diarrhea.
And are these people too frightened to go back to their homes?
There is 3 kinds of groups. One group of these IDPs, they lost their houses completely. One group that they are very afraid to go home, gangs problems and political problems. And the last group, their house were occupied illegally by other people. And the main problems are security.
That lack of security meant that not even the convent was safe from attack. Sister Guillermino says during the height of the factional violence in 2006, rival gangs surrounded the convent for 5 days, throwing rocks and stones over the wall. They targeted it for sheltering people from both sides. But Sister Guillermino showed she is not afraid to try and reason with the armed youths, despite being personally threatened with a knife or gun more than a dozen times.
At the time, we face a very big problems with different groups. Some unknown groups attack us, stoning us with rocks and carrying machetes around. And then for 5 nights, 4 days, and every single day, every single night, I went out to face them personally, talk to them. And I came out in agreement with them to make peace, reconciliation among these 2 groups of boys.
This, I know, is dangerous work, and you've actually been personally threatened. Tell us, how many times have you had a knife held to your neck or a gun pointed to your head?
A knife, machete, they pointed my hands at us for 11 times and guns for 3 times.
Were you very frightened?
Yeah, the first time I was very frightened. And then I prayed to God. I carried my cross. I carried my rosary. And I asked God, blessing God, come with me. And then I faced all these kinds of boys carrying guns. But I faced them with faith and all came out with peace and reconciliation.
Sister Germino says she spends a lot of her time shuttling back and forth between the different gangs, trying to convince them to patch up their quarrels.
At the time, I have to negotiate with different groups. Each group, I have to talk to them, even though sometimes I wanted to stop them on the street or in different villages. I stop them, talk to them, sitting on the road, talk to them personally and negotiate with them. And I went to another group, talk to that group, negotiate with them, come back to them, talk again to another group, and going and coming, until I got the objective of peace and reconciliation.
People, I gather, call you the Angel of Mercy. Are you determined to carry on this work despite the dangers involved?
Yeah, because that's my own initiative and trusting God that whatever has happened, even though I face different problems, I talk to them. Sometimes I shout from far away. They listen to me the first time, second time, third time they stop, and I manage to talk to them.
According to Sister Germino, one of the reasons for the factional violence in East Timor lies in the anger and frustration felt by many people when their nation's independence failed to bring about the expected improvement in their economic situation.
People are still living in poverty, without job. A good number of people drop out from school, financial problems. So that make people very angry. And so they use the political issues as an object for shouting out their anger and their wishes.
So do people feel frustrated a bit about what's happened in East Timor since independence? And do they have any thoughts of optimism that the future will be easier?
That's the wish of all the people, especially the youth members are waiting for the jobs. They wish that this government, the new government, should try to help people to stop the guns fighting so that they can rule these people and especially provide jobs for the youth members, because a good number of youth members without jobs, without education, so they are wishing for better life in the future, and they trust that this government should try to help out these people.
Susie Hodges was talking there to East Timorese sister Germina Marsal. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow if you can. Or don't forget, you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.